There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abuhul, Annabelle Corton, and the rest of the team, only on DubaiEye 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books with me, Annabelle Corson, and my co-host, James Mullen. With us in the studio, we've got Helen Farmer. And if you've just tuned in, we're in the middle of our Castaway segment where we've stranded Helen on a desert island with nothing but three books to keep her company. She's about to tell us about book three. Just a message for anybody listening. If you want to text in to 4001, let us know what books that you would like to take to a desert island with you. We've had one in. Somebody says, I'd take the whole box set of The Famous Five. That's Kenneth. Oh,
that's a brilliant suggestion. So, I can't wait till my daughter's old enough for a bit of Enid Blyton. As long as I don't want to go to boarding school because we can't afford it.
That's the thing, that's the danger though with these books. I mean, when you read Harry Potter or anything where there's a boarding school, I mean, my mum was bugged about boarding school for so many years.
Just for sheer midnight feast opportunities.
Yeah, pretty much.
Absolutely right.
So what's the third book that you've got for us?
Well, I've got it in front of me now, and in contrast, the Catelyn Moran book, which as we said is dog-eared and a bit waterlogged and pages turned down, my third book is Pretty Honest by Sally Hughes, and my copy is absolutely pristine, because I can't tell you how much I looked forward to buying and reading this book, and it's actually very, very precious to me, I think is the best way of putting it. So Sally Hughes is a beauty and lifestyle journalist. She writes for The Guardian. She writes a beauty column for The Guardian every weekend, and she also writes for a website called The Pool, which I love, which was co-founded by Sam Baker from Red Magazine and Lauren Laverne, who's a broadcaster in the UK. And I think the beauty of The Pool, it's not just about it's about what all women in their 30s or 40s are interested in. It's not just about beauty or parenting or politics. It's saying we're all well-rounded women. We want to be reading as much about career as we want to be reading about the news and, you know, which eye cream is going to make us look like we've had a bit more sleep. So, and that's very much reflective of her writing. She's very honest, and the book is called Pretty Honest. And in it, she draws on 20 years of wisdom and advice and kind of expertise and living and working in the beauty industry. And I am a bit of a secret beauty geek, to be honest. It's not something I ever kind of really write or talk about. And I really wish I had more friends who are into kind of beauty and kind of share that side of it. But this book was a real kind of escape for me. And it's an amazing book. It's about the different stages of your life and what you need in terms of beauty advice, hair, all of that, which sounds very superficial, but it's not at all. It's actually hugely insightful about these different stages.
My question would be, why would you take this to a desert island?
Because it would really cheer me up. I think that the language that she uses to describe products and the rituals of skincare and getting ready and those little luxuries, it's pure escapism for me. And I love the way she writes. And as I said, it's not just about beauty. She talks about life as a woman through those different stages, and you know, how to, you know, like the practical, from like how to choose a perfume to how to get beauty assistants to take you a bit more seriously. And I think one thing that Sally Hughes has come up again, you know, again and again and again through her career is that, you know, if you're into beauty, you can't be a feminist.
Yeah, and I think the two aren't mutually exclusive.
And it's such rubbish. You know, she does address it in her introduction, saying, "I believe looking good to be an important and valid pursuit. All too often, women with an interest in their appearance are seemed to be stupid, shallow, or unintelligent, even traitors to feminism. But I see good grooming and feminism as entirely complementary. For some, beauty is a matter of pride and self-respect. While a man with an interest in football, wine, Formula One, or even paintballing would never see his intelligence called into question, a woman with an interest in surface is perceived to have no depth. I believe it's perfectly normal to both love lipstick and literature, to be a woman who paints her nails by shouting at question time. Looking good makes us feel good, and the rituals involved are a pleasure in themselves." And I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, after giving birth, or, you know, if you're breastfeeding, if you're going through sickness, the ritual and taking that time to make yourself look better and feel better, should not be underestimated. And I think that's something that she speaks to really well in this book.
I was researching Sally Hughes and I was completely blown away because, and I was absolutely, I told you this, that I was absolutely guilty of what she says everybody else is guilty of assuming that because this is a book about beauty, it's going to be superficial, that she's superficial. And that's absolutely not the case.
No, it really isn't.
And when I was doing my research, I found out what inspired her to write the book, and I was completely moved by it. So she was inspired to write the book by her friend Carey, who ended up spending a lot of time in hospital because she was very ill, I believe, with cancer.
She sadly died since a few months ago, I think.
And the way she speaks about her friend is just, have a listen.
It was Carey who made me write Pretty Honest, unwittingly, but she had a huge tumour in her leg. And in 2011, she went in for the surgery and the consultant said to her, we're going to have to amputate the leg. The tumour is too big. We're going to have to amputate the leg. And when you come out of anaesthetic, you'll probably still feel the leg. That's normal. We'll work through that in physio. But we're not going to be able to save the leg. So she went into surgery, and when she woke up, she could feel the leg and she didn't look, and the consultant came round and said, have you looked? We saved your leg. And they had saved her leg. And she told me all this. I spoke to her after the operation and said, oh, what happened? And she told me this, and I said, what on earth do you do when you are told you're going to lose a leg and you wake up and you still have a leg? I can't imagine what that's like. What do you do? And she said, I painted my toenails. And I just completely understood. I completely understood. I think most women understand that sentiment. Like, my leg, yeah. I own it. I am going to control this situation. I am going to make it look pretty. I'm going to look down at my toes, see them still there, and they're going to be red or whatever they were.
That's it, isn't it? That control.
Absolutely. And while there's lots of kind of insights for life and the life stages, there's also hugely practical advice. And much like the Catlin Moran book, that I wish I'd been able to read that as a teenager, I really wish Pretty Honest had been available to me as a teenager, because I think there's so much in the media. I think generally speaking, women's magazines are not to be trusted in terms of recommendations because of the associated advertising and various pull from commercial factors. Sally Hughes is totally impartial when it comes to recommendations. So she talks about how to buy a wig. She talks about how to deal with teenage skin. She talks about various skin conditions, you know, really unsexy stuff like, you know, the eczema, or she suffers herself from super dry skin. And I had eczema growing up as well. And I wish I'd known some of the things or products available to me at that time. So I think women of all ages should definitely check out Pretty Honest. I learned a huge amount in terms of how to apply foundation and all that kind of stuff. But also it made me think about beauty in a very different way.
What about the industry itself? What are her reflections on the industry?
Well, she's not a snob, so she'd be quite happy to recommend, you know, a £3 serum from Superdrug, as she would to, you know, be in rhapsodies over a Creed aftershave that, you know, has been, you know, around for generations. And I really love the fact that she talks about, you know, what her favourite smells are, and that includes, you know, cheap Apple shampoo and those big tubs of gel and, you know, Imperial leather soap. So things that are in your life that you can enjoy and relish, and it might just, you know, cost a couple of quid, but it doesn't really matter because that can give you a great source of pleasure.
She's so relatable.
She's hugely relatable. Mm-hmm. I if I ever move back to the UK, I'm determined to make her my friend. And Catlin Moran, I basically want to be in their girl gang. But what I do love, and obviously it's called Pretty Honest, but one of her big bugbears is the celebrity world, and it's this unrealistic portrayal of womanhood and femininity, and how so few women are willing to come forward and say, I can juggle my life, I can be a mother and a wife and a friend and successful in my industry because I have paid for childcare. Or I look this amazing because I have a very good, Botox and plastic surgeon, you know, or I'm this skinny because I have a private chef. You know, it's all such fallacy. And she talks a lot about being honest, and really by being dishonest about those unrealistic aspects. It doesn't do anyone any justice at all. It doesn't serve other women. It's not sisterhood. And I think that's something in terms of my parenting blog. I'm not about being an aspirational parent. It's not about, you know, 5,000 dirham baby Dior dresses. It's, this was a bad day, this was a bad night, or that was a really unexpected source of joy. You know, it's about the ups and downs of, you know, motherhood and real life. And I think that's a real reflection of what she does for that beauty industry.
In terms of specific advice in the book, is there apparently a section where she takes you through, you know, the kind of thing that you would wear to court, or the kind of thing that you would wear to a funeral? So it's very, very specific.
It is very specific. So she would even talk about, you know, different kind of makeup brushes and what you need in your kit. So as I said, from a teen or someone that doesn't know what advice to trust. And as I said, in the media, you're bombarded with images and advice and you don't really know who to trust. And she is absolutely someone that I would hold up and say she's got no ulterior motive. She's not sponsored by anybody. She's just trying to
give pretty honest advice.
She's very honest. She's written a follow-up book called Pretty Iconic, which is different but equally enjoyable, and that looks at different beauty products through the ages, so classics, future classics, you know, scientific, etc. And each, it's almost like an essay on each product. It's almost like a love story talking about why she's chosen it and why it's been in her life and why perhaps you might want to get it in your life, but again, completely unbiased. So a really good source of information, and something I think then a lot of women will really resonate with. Even if you haven't got any mild interest in beauty, it might just spark a bit.
Also, just saying, it sounds like a perfect gift. Hint, hint, wink,
it's
wink.
It's available in Dubai, and it's a beautiful pale book, hardcover. It's a great gift.
I like that it's not bright pink, I have to say.
Exactly. She's a cool girl. We'd be friends with her, right?
So the books that we have spoken about today, what did we speak about today, James?
We had Caitlin Moran, we had Billy Collins, and we had a tremendous excerpt of him reading a very relevant poem, which I will be playing later. And then we had Sally Hughes with her Pretty Honest. So those were the three. I just want to know very quickly, what were the two that you left out then?
I left out Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret by Judy Blume. So Judy Blume was a woman that when I was kind of 10, I wanted her to be like my crazy aunt so I could ask her advice. And those books I think were really important. And I also, oh my goodness, oh, Bossy Pants by Tina Fey for a giggle.
Thank you very much, Helen Farmer. More when we come back.
From Agatha Christie to Jeffrey Archer, we've got it covered. Talking of books, here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello, welcome back to Talking of Books. We're focusing on the UAE in our Arab World segment today because we are joined over the phone by a wonderful guest called Alia Al-Mansouri, who is back from the trip of a lifetime.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Alia, hey.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great.
So when the Drive Live team spoke to you, Drive Live team, yeah, from Dubai Eye, that was quite a few weeks ago. You were in Cape Canaveral for the launch of your experiment. What happened after that? You met some rather interesting people, didn't you? That I saw mention of a Teen Vogue interview. Did you meet an astronaut?
Yeah. Actually, in the rocket launch, a lot of people were present there, and I got to meet a lot of people who are sending their experiments, from researchers, scientists, physicists, everyone. And I also got to meet two astronauts that have been on the shuttle missions, which was very exciting because it's one of the shuttles that I really love, which is Atlantis, and I got to meet them.
Great. Can you just fill us in a bit, Alia, on what exactly this experiment was and how you came to get involved in it?
Yeah, so the experiment, I won a competition called Jesus Space. This competition gave me a chance to send my experiment to the International Space Station. And so my experiment is about proteins called Hitchcock proteins. These proteins are expressed in the body when there are chemical and environmental stresses like heat. And so I want to see if these proteins will also be made by the body in the presence of radiation and microgravity.
This was something that was arranged by the UAE Space Agency, wasn't it?
Yeah, the competition was arranged originally it was arranged by Mini-PCR and Boeing, and then the UAE Space Agency brought it to the UAE to have it done here.
Why is this something that interests you? Why are you interested in the protection of astronauts on long journeys?
I've always been interested in how we can protect our bodies in space. Myself, I want to become an astronaut when I grow up, and I want to be among the first people who step foot on Mars for the first time. And so for that to happen, there are so many problems that we have to solve, and among them is protecting our bodies from microgravity and radiation that is highly present in Mars. And so solving that problem issue is really important to me.
And have you always been interested in space? What sparked your interest initially in it?
When I was a kid, I actually used to think that I was an alien for some weird reason. My brother used to tell me that, and I was always interested in science fiction and all these science fiction books, Star Wars, and the movies, everything. And so from science fiction, I got to learn actual science at some point, and I really loved it. And I decided to do science on my own as well, I guess.
Any sci-fi books in particular that inspired you? Can you remember any titles?
I guess I read a lot of like fantasy and stuff. There were these series of books. I don't actually remember the. Yeah, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, something young. Like that. I read when I was really young, and I don't even remember most of the things that I read.
You're my favorite person in the world right now.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite books of all time.
Yeah, so I really have to reread it again because I remember absolutely loving it, and that was the thing that really got me into space. So,
and you mentioned Star Wars as well.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of the bad guy, or are you Team Vader, or are you Team Skywalker?
Skywalker, probably.
Okay. And also, I was wondering, a project you may be familiar with is called the Mars One Project. Are you familiar with that project?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. I want to know would you be willing to permanently move to Mars? Is that something that you would want to do? You say you want to be an astronaut. Do you see yourself being able to go to another planet, or would you miss Earth too much?
I feel like if it was for the sake of science and actually doing experiments and learning more about us and making my country proud, if it takes living on a whole other planet, I would do it. And I think that there's so much about Mars that we don't know yet, and maybe a year or two won't even be enough to explore the whole planet. And so I would be willing to actually go and live there, but my parents wouldn't agree with that.
So it must have been really exciting to watch the rocket take off with your experiment in it. What's the actual process then? What happens? How does the experiment happen?
So after winning the competition, I already had a mentor when I was chosen top five in the competition, and she really did help me with preparing the experimental design. Since I'm 15 and I've never done anything similar like this, so she did help me with preparing the experimental design and actually bringing my experiment to life. And so she is studying her PhD at Harvard, and the summer before my experiment launch, I got to go to Harvard and go to her lab and actually prepare my experiment. And then it was shipped off to Kennedy Space Center by FedEx, literally the most normal thing, and then on its way to the International Space Station.
I love the fact that it traveled by FedEx and then was launched into space. Like two very different forms of travel for your experiment.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the next step in this? So it's been launched into space. I mean, are you going to have any further involvement? What happens next?
Well, it has actually already been done. The experiment has already been done by astronaut Peggy Whitson. And she already did it. I've seen a few pictures, and it looked very exciting. And it's coming back to Earth. They're planning on bringing the samples back to Earth on September 17th. So we'll see how that goes, and hopefully I'll get to know the results from that.
Fingers crossed. I have another question. I want to know who your heroes are.
I guess, my hero is, I think, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. I know he's not a scientist or he's not an astronaut, but I feel like he's very humble and kind, and that's someone that I aspire to be as a person, really.
I mean, it's a very exciting time to be in the UAE when it comes to space. You know, it's a small country here, but the impact that the UAE is having on space exploration is phenomenal. And for you as a teenager here, it must be an incredibly exciting time for you.
Yeah, it definitely is. I remember being a kid and not having all of these like space agencies and Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center, and now growing up, being able to see them grow and actually come to life is amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible. You are an inspiration, and thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us about your space adventures. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alia.
Thank you so much. Bye.
So that was Alia Al-Mansouri with her adventures in the States, launching her experiment, Genes in Space. She was the winner of that competition.
A phenomenal opportunity for her, and she sounds incredibly excited by it. And September the 17th is the next big day. I'm sure, you know, a massive day for her family. And also for the UAE.
She's only 15 as well.
Yes,
absolutely. Do I look slightly green with envy? Yeah, so also I was reminded by the fact that we actually had Chris Hadfield, famous Canadian astronaut, come to the Literature Festival. I think it was last year. And I just remember meeting him and just thinking, if she was meeting all these people, it really is. You do get starstruck, no pun intended there.
Yes, and a very, very firm handshake at Mr. Hadfield.
Yeah, so Chris Hadfield has the firmest handshake that I've ever felt. It's just, he looks at you straight in the eye, shakes your hand, and all you see is his face, and that's just blown away.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy who sang the David Bowie song in space. It wasn't Space Oddity.
Yeah.
Became famous for that, but he also took, it was a book of photographs, wasn't it, that he took when he was up in the space station, which is absolutely phenomenal. You should if you've got, I think it's about 150 dirhams, go and buy that book. It is absolutely fantastic.
It's a coffee table book to end all coffee table books.
Yeah, absolutely.
Much. Yeah. So yeah, that was our Arab World segment with Alia Al-Mansouri. So I'm glad we got to cover a little bit of space travel today. Really exciting. When we come back, we are going to be answering the question, why dogs, or how dogs, can help improve your reading ability.
From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
And welcome back to Talking Books. Quite a packed show we've had already, Annabelle.
Yeah, we have. So we've just spoke, what have we done today? We've done picture books, we've covered three books, we've stranded somebody on a desert island, which is my favourite thing in the world. It sounds really mean, but it's entertaining, so it's worth it. And we spoke to Alia Al-Mansouri, who sent an experiment up into space. And now we've got something that I like to call festival moment, because I constantly get asked when I say that I work for the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature or the Emirates Literature Foundation. They don't really quite understand what a literature festival is. If you haven't seen one in another part of the world, one person came up to me and said, so is it an author just standing and shouting their book at me? And that's not necessarily what it is. It basically is a series of really interesting discussions and conversations. And I've got a little clip here of John Ronson, who wrote The Psychopath Test, Men Who Stare at Goats. And here he's talking about his book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
You know, this is one of the problems with social media, is that it's creating a world of magnificent heroes or sickening villains. Like, it's a stage for constant artificial high dramas, where every day somebody emerges as a great hero or a terrible villain, on the scantest of evidence, on no evidence. And in fact, you know, the night of Justine Sacco, if anybody had said, can we not just wait until her plane lands to give her a chance to explain herself, the internet would have torn into those people that night. That night, patience and curiosity were considered weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And what was considered a strength was instant judgment. Mm-hmm. And then we all go home and watch Making a Murderer, mm-hmm. and whose side are we on? The kind-hearted defense attorney. But give us the power of justice, mm-hmm. and we're not the kind-hearted defense mm-hmm. attorney, we're the hanging judge.
Mm-hmm. There you go, John Ronson being as eloquent as ever about public shaming.
Absolutely, and again, a book you should read. I mean, I read The Psychopath Test about 6 months ago, And that a phenomenal piece of work, which will actually make you look at the world in a different way and look at the people around you in a different way, because what you become aware of is that psychopaths are with us. Generally, they're bosses, CEOs of organizations. But it's a fascinating book. He's a great writer, and it was great to have him at the festival. Hopefully, he'll come back again soon.
Well, psychopaths aren't with us in the studio today.
No, absolutely.
Instead, we have a very lovely guest. We've got Carolyn Thompson, who is our guest for The Big Question today. Now, just to recap, The Big Question today is one that I have always wanted to know the answer to, although I didn't know I did until recently. And that is, how can dogs improve someone's reading ability? So, Carolyn Thompson, you are the founder of the Animal Agency and Reading Dogs UAE. Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Very good, thank you. Thanks for having me along.
So, what is Reading Dogs UAE?
So, Reading Dogs is a newly launched project. We take trained dogs into schools, educational facilities, and other private venues, and we help children with their reading. So we work with small groups of around about 6 to 10 children, and they basically read to the dog.
What is it about dogs that's better at encouraging children to read than, say, a teacher at the front of a classroom?
I think one of the main issues children have is lack of confidence or a fear of failure. And when they're reading to a dog, the dog doesn't judge them, it doesn't correct them, it doesn't hurry them along. And so they become more confident in their own ability and they enjoy reading, which makes them want to do it more. And that's what the studies are finding, just how many benefits it's having not only to their reading fluency, but also socially and emotionally. So it's a really exciting project that we can't wait to launch this month.
And it's in terms of this particular enterprise, dogs, children reading to dogs, it's been around now for what is it? It's about 25, 30 years, started in the States?
It did, yeah. So it became much more popular about 8, 9 years ago in the States, not only in schools but libraries, because libraries found that by bringing dogs in, they could encourage families to come in and new readers. And from there, it's kind of spread to the rest of the world. So UK, Australia are doing it more now, and a lot of the Scandinavian countries as well.
And how did you come to get involved in this?
Well, my company, the Animal Agency, we put trained animals into the film and advertising industry here. And when I launched 2.5 years ago, it was always with the view of doing something educational or something that would benefit animal welfare. So throughout that time I've been looking at projects around the world, what can we do? Saw this one and just loved it. I feel like here children often don't get as much chance to interact with dogs, and it kind of combined two of my favourite things, reading and dogs. So that's where it all started from. We also had this huge database of well-trained dogs with the agency, so why not use them?
And what sort of dogs are you using then? I mean, is it a mixture of all types?
It is. You'd be surprised. So we've got tiny little Maltese, we've got pugs, we've got our largest one is a big rescue Alsatian called Lost, a few golden retrievers, labs. So, yeah, there's no kind of stereotype of what a reading dog is. We work with a great dog trainer who puts them through assessment and training and just sees if they're going to be suitable. And We have 10 dogs now. We've got another 8 going through the process. So it's quite a long process to get them assessed and certified.
I'm just thinking about my dogs now. Because I have one of my dogs is a husky. I don't think he'd be suitable for the programme. He's a little bit bonkers.
Oh, is he? The children would love that, though.
So in terms of like what kind of dogs that you have for the programme, you said you've got about 8 to 10.
We've got 10 at the moment, 8 going through assessment.
Okay. So. I was speaking to the trainer about this, but in your opinion, I mean, what makes a reading dog, basically? I mean, do they have to be calm all the time? Because my dog would not be able to do that.
No, and we don't want that. We want something, we want to find dogs that the children will engage with. So that might be they look cute, or they're particularly big, or they're inquisitive. So we work with what we tend to do is try and find a number of different dogs that have different kind of benefits and personalities, and then match them to the school or match them to the children they're working with. We work with them so that in the schools each they know where to sit. So they can go in, they can sniff around, they can say hi to the children, they can interact with them. But once the reading session starts, they know where the mats are and they'll go and sit down there with the children.
And how many children is it per dog? What does the group look like?
We tend to do between 6 to 10. So it depends on age and ability. But that way it means that each child gets a chance to read to the dog. So each session's around about 20 minutes. 5 minutes of that is greeting the dog. Just a real brief reminder of how do you interact with the dog? How do you approach the dog? And then we go into the reading session. So it depends on ability, but each child has 2 to 4 minutes to read to the dog.
And is it focused mainly on kids who are having difficulty reading, or is it across the board?
It's across the board, and we've seen that schools are using it in different ways. So some schools are using it particularly for their SEND children. Some are using it for children where English isn't their first language. And then some just offering it out to anyone that's interested. So it really depends from school to school. I think the research has found that the biggest improvement is in those that are nervous or perhaps not natural readers.
Have you had any great success stories so far, you know, where you've gone into a school and there's been a magical moment?
Yeah, not yet. So we're launching this month. Mm-hmm. So hopefully next time we speak, we'll have a few of those for you. We're for the last 9 months or so, we've been putting the dogs through assessment, getting everything set up, so all the insurances in place, speaking to schools, understanding the requirements of what we need, so that now we're ready to go.
And how many schools have you got involved so far then?
It's been really encouraging. It's been great. And interestingly, not all... So we've seen a broad range of curriculums, nationalities and everything get involved. So we've got around about 12 schools at the moment. Talim have been brilliant in regards to looking at it for their schools, but we're also speaking to a number of other ones as well. We're rolling out the pilot scheme at Safford British School. So for us, it was important to take what works in the rest of the world and run this pilot scheme and get the feedback from parents, teachers, children, and then adapt it if needed before we move on to offering it out to the other schools.
I do wonder whether there's been, has there been any opposition at all from schools or parents about this? Has it been a hard sell at any point?
It's actually not, which has been great. We have had a lot of support from the schools, but they have taken their time to understand it and work out how it's going to work best with their school. So do we have to have an area away from the main entrance? How are they going to communicate with their parents that we're going to be in there? And one of the things that we have offered is, before we start the project in the school, to run a parents' evening or a parents' meeting. So we go along, we present, we bring the dogs.
And they can ask all their questions. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and that's really helped.
But I was looking at your website, and it's not just dogs you've got. You've got lots of other animals that potentially children could read to. You've got what? Yep. You've got owls?
Everything. So we've got lots of birds, falcons, owls. We've got lots of cute tortoises, guinea pigs. There's a lot of the scarier ones, the tarantulas and snakes.
Did you say tarantulas?
And snakes.
What?
Yeah, and little bearded dragons.
I don't quite fancy reading to a tarantula, sorry.
I don't know how many will want to.
But owls sound fantastic. Do you have any sloths?
We don't, no.
Now, a reading sloths programme, that's something that I'd sign up for. Although they wouldn't really be doing much listening, would they? They'd just be falling asleep. I had a text message come in that said, what if one of the dogs is a psychopath?
Oh, well, we do have a great dog trainer, an assessor, and we have a structured assessment programme that they go through to make sure that doesn't happen. So once they're through the gates, we can trust them completely. And that's an ongoing thing. So we reassess them on a regular basis, and we work very closely with the dog owners to understand, have they been sick? Have they shown anything in the last week or 2 weeks that we should be concerned about?
So are you still looking for people to volunteer dogs for the programme, or have you got enough for the time being?
We're always looking. We thought we'd have enough to launch, but from the feedback, we think we need more. So we are welcoming new dogs for assessment, and that can be done through the website. And then a member of our team will get in touch to tell you about the assessment process.
And what's in it for the owners of this? What do you think they get out of it?
Well, they do get paid, but it is a nominal amount, so there is that. But the owners that we're working with just want to do something to help the community, but also to have their dogs interact with children, not only for the child's benefit, but it's also something interesting for the dog to do rather than be stuck at home all day. Quite a number of them are either involved in education, so we've got a lot of teachers that are doing it, or in dog care, or have been involved in similar schemes in their home countries.
Mm-hmm. And what about, have you got a dog?
Yes.
and is that dog going to be involved in the program too?
One of them is. Yeah. So I've got a rescue terrier who's brilliant. So he is. And then I have a very old Great Dane who just prefers the quiet life. So she's not involved. She prefers to be at home.
I'm interested to know if this program isn't just rolled out in schools in other parts of the world. I mean, it's still applicable to adults, isn't it? Adults who struggle with reading, if you're dyslexic or have any reading or learning challenges.
It is, and it's something they do a lot of in the US. And then in the UK they have, it's called Pets as Therapy. Mm-hmm. So they work one-on-one with adults that might have reading or learning difficulties or some sort of disability as well. And the benefits are still there, although they see them more on the emotional and social side with along with the reading kind of improvement.
Okay. More on this when we come back. Text in to 4001. We'll still get those texts while we're away.
From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle Corton. With me in the studio, James Mullen, and our lovely guest, Carolyn Thompson from Reading Dogs UAE. Before we get back into that conversation, I've had a couple of text messages in from our earlier segment where we were talking about what books we would take to a desert island. Somebody texted in saying Pride and Prejudice, personal favourite of mine. I've loved it and reread it for 36 years. The dynamics of the Bennett family always makes me smile. We also had somebody say, I would take Island Living by Archipelago. Gavin. Yes, yeah. Very funny. So, Carolyn, you were talking earlier about your trainer, yes. Denise, for Reading Dogs. I actually had the opportunity to speak to her. This is her telling us what's involved in a training session for Reading Dogs and how a Reading Dog becomes a Reading Dog.
Most important thing is for the dog to be calm. They may come from a family environment, but that's not a prerequisite. They could just be from a couple. And if I go to a client's house and I think, oh yeah, this dog could be a good candidate for a Reading Dog, I ask them then to get in touch with Carolyn, and we then ask them to come along for a formal assessment. And this could be sort of five dogs in a group, takes about half an hour, and I would ask dogs then to all walk around together, and I'm looking for any signs of aggression, or if they're not confident, or they feel a bit stressed, then they wouldn't go through to the next part. The next part is then I actually interview the parents of the dogs and ask them, you know, how they behave, are they from a family background, and then they'll give me some idea of what the background of the dog is. The next part is we then actually, if we're happy with that, I then ask the dog to be put into a little group of, we have test children who are used to dogs, and I actually watch then very carefully how the dog interacts with the children. This is the most important part because I have to be really careful that the dog isn't stressed or looking restless or looking around for its owner. The owner is always in, you know, a fair distance of the dog, so the dog is reassured, and then the children actually start reading to the dogs, and that's the best bit.
That sounds wonderful. How do you know when they're ready to enter the classroom? Is there a moment where it's very clear, or is it just something that you realise over the period of training them?
It's usually over the period of training. I mean, initially, I sometimes have a gut reaction to a dog, and I'll think, I may want to see that dog separately on a different occasion, or I may ask them to come back to be reassessed. And that would then result in me suggesting that they do a few more sit and stay commands, very basic commands, because The actual session for reading dog isn't normally more than 15 minutes because it's very hard for a child or a dog to keep their attention. You've probably heard the saying, never work with children or animals. So
you're ticking both boxes both, here.
You have both of them together then. So it is always, you know, it's a tension thing. It's hard for a dog to stay very still and quiet for a long period of time. That they are our preferred dogs. But there's no failures. We never have failures because every dog has come usually from a loving family. So they are part of that family unit.
So that was Denise Vertigan, who is your trainer for Reading Dogs UAE. Have you had any difficulties in launching Reading Dogs UAE in terms of like paperwork and red tape? How hard has that been?
It is a new scheme. We're the first people to do it in the UAE and I think the first in the Middle East. So it's been a lot of background work. We've been kind of working away since the start of the year on it. And the main issue was finding good insurance, so a policy that understood what we do and what we need to cover. And then also understand from that policy what we need to do. So these dogs need to be assessed. They need to be also have a full vet check and have up-to-date jabs and all the rest of things. So that took a lot of time and a lot of backwards and forwards getting that in place. We had to do a lot of meetings with schools to understand what their requirements were. They were really the main issues. But to be honest, it's been a good process to go through. Now that we're launching, we know we have everything in place. We've done risk assessments. Everything's ready to go. And that's really been possible through the support of the dog owners, the schools that want to be involved in the scheme, Denise, and also the sponsors that have come in on a new project they didn't know about. Karim have backed us. And that's given us the investment to be able to move forward with it. So yeah, it's been a long process behind the scenes, but now it's all in place and we're really excited.
When's the official launch date? You said this month it's rolling out, but do you have an official date?
So the pilot scheme starts the week of the 24th of September. So that's our official launch date, and we're going put everything behind it to get it going, and then we then roll into other schools and other venues from the week commencing the 4th of October.
What is your pilot school?
Saffa British School on Maidan Street. So we're in there, we're working with children from FS1 up until their older children, and also their SEN children as well. So we're really looking to get feedback from every age group, every ability level, and also from everyone.
For anyone who doesn't know, I mean, what age bracket is that?
It's around about, we're working around about 4 to 12.
Okay.
So, and then, as I mentioned earlier, if they are younger, we will have smaller groups. And if they're not at the stage that they can read yet, we'll look at playing games with them. So we've got trump cards, you know, top trumps, mm-hmm. that have all the reading dogs on them, so they can learn about the dogs, play that. We'll also focus more on the learning about animals, learning about dogs, how to approach them, what you should and shouldn't do, and then build up to starting to read with them.
And how would somebody get in contact with you? How would they get in touch with you?
If they head to our website, which is readingdogsuae.com, it's got all the information on there. It's got our contact details, and it's also got the online registration form if they want to register their dog. We would say to schools to get in touch as soon as possible. We have 10 dogs at the moment, and although we're looking to build that up, we do think we'll get fairly busy fairly quickly.
I would like to sign my husky up for it, but I was just thinking of another problem. He likes books so much that he eats them. So I just feel like that might get in the way a little bit. Last book he ate the ending of my book. So I had to do the classic dog ate my homework. This was actually true. Do you have an office? I mean, can we visit the Reading Dogs? Is that possible? If anybody doesn't want to submit their dog for Reading Dogs, can we just go down and say hi?
We don't have an office. So each of the dogs is owned by a dog owner. So we work with them and we travel around to schools and venues. But what we are doing is working with private venues, so likes of Al Sirkal Avenue. We've also been in talks with other pet-friendly venues about bringing the dogs there, and then it's less of a formal session. It's more so people can come down and join us. And we're always willing to bring them in here if you'd like to see them.
One question. We've got four cats at home. Yeah. Why not cats?
Well, it's a good question. Cats do tend to do their own thing, though.
They'll wander away. Yeah, they're not going to pay too much attention.
Yeah, they do. Cats have a shorter attention span as well.
Yeah, see, dogs rule. Sorry, I'm a dog person. thank you so much for coming in the studio, Carolyn. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. We'll be back very soon with more. A murder mystery, I believe, from the golden age of crime.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.